From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with Dacher Keltner and Jason Marsh, the editors of The Compassionate Instinct, the science of human goodness.
Hello, I'm Jason Ponton, the editor-in-chief of Technology Review, MIT's magazine that focuses on the future of technology, with cutting-edge tech news every day on the web at technologyreview.com.
I asked UC Berkeley psychology professor Dacher Keltner, before we get to the science, is there any question as to what makes up the elements of human goodness?
Well, I think that from a scientific and also an ethical perspective, that's one of the hardest questions is, how do we define human goodness? How does it apply in different cultures and different contexts? And we take something of an ecumenical approach and we say it involves all kinds of emotions and strategies. But you can think about one set of the elements of goodness being about enhancing the welfare of others. And all ethical, spiritual traditions have been writing about that. And that's the science we focus on. Things like compassion and altruism and gratitude and the like. And another very important and underappreciated part of human goodness is how humans have evolved and developed culturally these abilities to reconcile in the midst of conflict, right? How to forgive.
And horrendous conflict.
Right. Just unimaginable conflict. And that's a very big part of the story.
When we talk about the elements of human goodness, we frequently hear compassion, empathy, altruism, but we also hear forgiveness, for example, gratitude, apology. All of these things seem to always include other people, one other person, a set of other people. Is goodness have to do with more than yourself? I mean, is that part of the basic definition?
Well, that's certainly, I think, the working definition that we've been operating by in the work that we've been doing with Greater Good Magazine and the Greater Good Science Center. It truly is about the greater good, not just satisfying your own personal desire or promoting your own personal happiness, but really achieving a deeper level of meaning and purpose and even happiness in your own life through the relationships that you cultivate with others and by promoting the welfare of others. So certainly, I think by our definition and by the logic of this book and of our magazine and our center, truly promoting goodness and living a good life is really about cultivating strong, meaningful, compassionate relationships with others.
Now, where does the science come in?
Well, I mean, these are the question of human goodness is a deep scientific question, right? Where is it located in the brain and in our genes, perhaps, and in our nervous systems? And so what has happened in and what really inspired our center and then the science that I do at Berkeley is there's really this new movement in evolution and neuroscience to begin to understand why we act altruistically. And that's in part because there are parts of the brain and parts of the nervous system that help you act pro-socially, right? Is that encoded in a particular set of genes that create those physiological systems? And we've discovered a little oxytocin receptor gene that maps to really empathetic behavior.
And oxytocin's a hormone, right?
It is. It's a peptide that floats through your brain and your bloodstream that helps promote caring and trusting behavior. And there are genes that regulate those systems. And we're starting to map, inspired by this movement, some of those genetic markers. So it's a great question scientifically.
Yeah, and I would add also that the science also comes in, and that, as Dacher mentioned, there's a pretty broad spectrum of philosophies and notions of the good life or of morality and ethics and compassion spanning religious traditions or cultural traditions. And by looking to the science, you're able to in some ways transcend some of the religious differences and not seem sectarian or that you're choosing one religious tradition over another, but instead looking to some empirical notions of what constitutes goodness and how you might measure the good life and looking for scientific proof that goes beyond any particular set of religious beliefs to help establish some common criteria for essentially the way to living a good, compassionate, altruistic life.
Well, you don't just deal with these positive emotions, although most of these are positive. I mean, there is forgiveness versus revenge, and both can be studied, right?
No, definitely. I mean, I think what's important for generations, really, social sciences and psychology in particular, have really just sought to understand the roots of the negative behaviors. And there's a lot to be said for that. And obviously,
And let's stop them.
Well, no, it's also taking the work that's been established and building on it and looking not just to understand the negative, but understand from that understanding, how do we then promote the positive? And it would be probably fruitless just to try to promote reconciliation and forgiveness without understanding why people seek revenge in the first place. So it's not necessarily disregarding or trying to ignore the negative, but it's using it as a constructive basis for helping to establish more positive relationships with others, both cultivating the positive and seeking the sources of the negative to understand how we might both curtail the negative and build on it for more positive relationships.
Well, in the Compassionate Instinct, you've assembled the writings of over 20 people, some of whom are easily recognizable. Desmond Tutu, Harvard psychology professor Steven Pinker, Stanford biology and neurology professor Robert Sapolsky. And there's even a dialogue with the Dalai Lama with Paul Ekman, you know, the great UCSF professor who is so well known for micro expressions and trust and lying. And that I guess he could tell if the Dalai Lama was lying. I guess that's what that interview had to be about. Yeah. Now, how do all these contributions from this diverse set of people, how do they fit into this science of human goodness?
One answer to that, Moira, is that about 15 years ago, the science of human goodness was really woefully underdeveloped. And we knew a lot about fight or flight physiology. We know a lot about stress. Many of your listeners know about cortisol and the damages that it can bring about, this stress hormone to your body. And 15 years ago, there were thousands of studies of fear and anger and not a single study of compassion or gratitude. And so what we assembled in the Compassionate Instinct is what amounts to a movement, a set of thinkers who are interested in questions like what Steve Pinker addresses of why in the world has culture become more peaceful, which seems counterintuitive, or Robert Sapolsky studying his baboons and asking how in the world does an aggressive tribe become more cooperative? And I think they were all galvanized, these writers, by just this basic question of where is goodness in our human nature?
Now, Jason, you interviewed UCSF professor Paul Ekman along with his daughter. Now, as you say opening the interview, can you imagine, you know, trying to grow up in these United States with your father knowing whether you're lying or not? I mean, perhaps the world's leading expert. And yet the interview had to do more with the development of good and truthfulness in his daughter and establishing trust.
Yeah, and I think Paul Ekman was uniquely positioned. Obviously, he was a world expert on facial expression and lying in particular, and had even written a book called Why Kids Lie. So having him as a father would be challenging, as I think, you know, he recognized. But I think what was interesting is that in that interview, we spoke to both Paul Ekman, the scientist, and Paul Ekman, the father. And Paul Ekman, the scientist, was informed by years and decades of training. Paul Ekman, the father, was informed by some of the same research, but also his own experiences growing up and learn from his own parents as to what not to do in raising your own kids. And what he was able to bring to his own experience as a parent was not just an understanding of why kids lie from a scientific perspective, but also from a very personal perspective. And that's really what we've tried to do in the book as a whole, is combine the science and the stories and try to make the science, put the science in very personal, practical terms for the lay reader. And I think that interview is actually one of the best examples in the book of how we've tried to do that, and how when the science and the storytelling and the personal and the scientific come together, they're really far more illuminating than either in isolation would be otherwise.
And he gives very specific examples of how he would approach his daughter so that he's not putting her in a position to lie. Yeah. You know, he knows, okay, it's a setup. She already is doing something she wasn't supposed to be doing. How do I ask that question? And rather than learning, you know, specific things to say to your daughter mm-hmm. or your mm-hmm. son at specific times, he's looking at it in a sort of a higher level view. How do I not corner the person? You know, when somebody's lying, you know, you say, I'm going to corner you. Right. Never works yeah. out. No. It never works no. out.
Yeah.
Especially if you're looking to build a long-term trusting relationship. This is someone who, you know, you're not just looking to catch them in a lie and move on and sever your relationship with them. I mean, this is, if you want over decades and decades to have a lasting trusting relationship with your child, you know, what he discovered and what proved to be true for him and Eve was that it wasn't about playing gotcha or making them look bad or making them just feel remorseful and shameful. It was really about treating them as someone that you respect and someone that you trust and want to show a certain degree of trust to, even if in one instance they violated that trust. Doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to withhold your trust from them in the future or, you know, eye them far more skeptically in the future. What it really means is that you use that as a learning opportunity to help them both recognize where they went wrong and, you know, why they might have told the lie in the first place, but also learn that telling the truth would not bring dire consequences, but would only serve to, in the long run, help them develop a more trusting relationship with their parent and ultimately give them even more freedom because the parent feels like they are in a position to trust their kid because they don't expect them to lie or abuse that trust in the future.
You know, it's interesting, Mario. I've known Paul and Eve since Eve was 7 or 8 because I worked in Paul's lab and I teach Paul's science of lying to almost every audience that I speak to. And people always ask this question that Jason got at in the interview, which is, what in the world would it be like to live with that guy? And in a way, it's a greater good lesson, which is he discloses for the first time in that interview, he says, I don't want to do these gotcha traps, right, because that's pernicious to family. And I want to create a platform of absolute trust that I assume my child will recognize and act on. And that, I felt, was it was a revelation in that essay.
So knowledge is power, showing yeah. you how to use it.
That's right, yeah. For good.
For the good, for the good. Now, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich is known for reducing everything to the numbers. He considers the cost of apathy in the U.S. It's like you're trying to do good, but we're just going to be apathetic about it. It's sort of the choice to not act.
Professor Reich has a really interesting perspective on not just social well-being, but economic well-being. And he's able to make the case really convincingly, I think, and he makes it in this interview, he's made it in talks, that ultimately, if people are interested in promoting their own self-interest, they need to look out for fellow members of their society. Because ultimately, if we see the gaps between the haves and the have-nots widening to a greater and greater extent, ultimately, we'll be living in a far more chaotic, even far more dangerous society than we live in now. So he's able to make the case that having empathy for those who have less than you, who may be in a position of greater need, and reaching out to them and seeing commonalities with them ultimately doesn't only serve their interests and help them rise up the socioeconomic ladder, but it also serves to promote one's own sense of well-being and even safety.
And if you don't feel like doing it just for the good of it, if you feel like saying, I just want to do something good for myself, do it because it will be good for yourself.
Yeah.
You know, coming and going.
and you know, Moira, this is, there are a couple of comments on this. I mean, you know, Professor Reich's comments, first of all, are comments that are very unusual in economic circles, that this empathy gap and this inequality gap are costly and things we need to be worried about when you think about CEO salary structures and the like, on the controversies that surround them. And what we're learning from the social and health sciences is that this inequality gap that Reich has been interested in his whole career costs citizens in terms of happiness. It produces aggravated health problems around the country, all the way down to children suffering from greater asthma. This is an economic problem as well as an empathy problem, and Reich does that really effectively. And the new neuroscience of doing good, which is what he's interested in, being empathetic, shows you get this big buzz of activation in your nucleus accumbens, part of your brain that is associated with rewards. So being good, as Reich anticipates, has its own inherent reward, which is, again, to have, as Greater Good does in this collection of essays, have scientists communicating with policymakers is a really important conversation.
And science even tells us that a compassionate behavior, and I come out of the Jesuit tradition, being of service to others, it's actually healthy for us.
When Jason and I started working together 6-7 years ago, we took stock of where we were and as a culture, and I think it was really at this crest of self-interest, right? And a lot of the data show young people were more materialistic than ever, people more interested in the bottom line than a philosophy of life and the like. And I think what our collection of essays and the Compassionate Instinct arrives at is this old wisdom of actually happiness is found and self-interest is found in serving others in a way. And so we're hopefully part of that conversation.
Now, on a slightly different note, Desmond Tutu, the Nobel Peace Prize winner and former chair of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, is talking about how we forgive as societies, how we may have that process happen, and they've been amazingly successful coming out of a terrible, terrible situation. Why is truth so important to this forgiveness process? Why can't you just say, oh, I forgive.
Yeah.
I forgive.
Yeah. I think this comes up both in terms of talking about forgiveness and talking about apology, in some ways both ends of the equation, is that it becomes a lot easier to forgive someone when you feel like the person truly recognizes what it is that they may have done, what transgression they may have committed in the first place. And the person themselves recognizes that they're not hiding anything else from you. They're not trying to pull one over on you or deceive you in any way. They're being totally truthful about what they've committed and are willing to move forward in a more trusting and open relationship. And I think in the essay, also in the volume on apology, there's also the notion that when someone's apology doesn't truly imply that they completely recognize what transgression they committed in the first place, the apology may not only serve to not promote reconciliation, but it may make the person on the other end more resentful than they were to begin with and more angry than they were.
You can actually make it worse.
Exactly. You can make it worse.
A partial little, sorry about that.
Right, exactly. So, true recognition of the wrong that you committed and, a willingness then to seek forgiveness and apologize for it truly and deeply and openly is what truly promotes reconciliation after the fact, more so than maintaining any type of relationship based on deceit or mistrust.
And he's very clear. It's painful to hear the truth, because once the truth starts rolling, you thought this much was wrong. It turned out a whole lot more happened. And that's painful, but essential.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're seeing that in Rwanda now. They've done the same sorts of Truth and Reconciliation Commission work in Rwanda, and the observations are very much in keeping with what you've said, which is the truth is disturbing and it's alarming and unsettling to live with someone who may have killed one of your family members, but it creates this fragile peace, which is critical.
And then that move over to empathy.
Yeah.
In Ekman's interview with the Dalai Lama, part of what they're talking about is how do you become empathetic to someone on the other half of the world? You have no idea what their circumstance is, who they are as people. How do you create, what that challenge that is, to become empathetic to people who are in a completely different circumstance than you?
This is something that people have been astonished by. Like Peter Singer, the ethicist at Princeton, is writing about the central task of the development of culture is the expansion of our sense of empathy and empathizing for non-kin, for people in different communities, even for other species. And I think that's what readers of The Compassionate Instinct have been struck with respect to Steve Pinker's essay too, is, my goodness, we're developing greater empathy for all kinds of different individuals, and that may be our best prospects, is to cultivate that emotion.
I was a little shocked when I first got into it, because with all that's going on in the world today, it's like, Stephen, are you really telling us that there's less violence? I mean, what is his argument?
His argument is essentially that although we see a tremendous amount of violence around us every day, you know, in our own neighborhoods, in our own country, around the world, when you compare that violence with the indiscriminate violence that really shadowed and devastated the human species for thousands and thousands of years previously, we are essentially living in perhaps the most peaceful time in human record. Is that we have, yes, astonishing numbers of casualties from, you know, world wars over the past 100 years, but the types of indiscriminate violence and the types of moral codes that now exist to prevent violence are truly speak volumes about the degree to which our culture has evolved to make violence far less normative and acceptable in our society and even around the world.
You know, back on the conversation between the Dalai Lama and Paul Ekman, which resulted in a book, and we've had events around that, that's a really interesting case where this kind of conversation that we've been promoting for the past 6-7 years shows that people working in the great spiritual traditions and the ethical traditions, like Tibetan Buddhism, several thousand years of contemplation on what compassion is, right? They have sophisticated descriptions of this emotion. And scientists like Paul Ekman and myself started having conversations with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, seeing these monks, seeing what it did for them. And that has spurred a very exciting science on compassion.
You used the word gratitude earlier.
I really like the definition that Bob Emmons in The Compassionate Instinct arrives at. He's a gratitude researcher, really a pioneer, where he says that gratitude is more than just being thankful. It really is having a reverence for what's given to you. And that really starts to capture this sense that there are wondrous things that come your way, and many things, right? You just your children or the ability to eat or what have you. And the lesson on gratitude, which we promote, is one of the real success stories of this science, which is 10 years ago, people didn't talk about gratitude, right? There wasn't a coherent conversation around it. And as we started to learn that teaching kids to just be a little bit more grateful in their mindset helps out in family, helps their health, helps their grades, there is a very robust conversation on gratitude right now. It's in the workplace, it's in schools, and we are thrilled to be part of that science. So.
And I see that also it's described in terms of couples, which are very hard to be a couple, hard to be one of a couple, but that establishing this basis, this interaction of gratitude about each other and what the gifts that you are bringing, which are not, we're not always talking about, frankly.
Right, exactly. And which especially, you know, in some ways, gratitude is a recognition of the gift, of a gift that someone else has given you. It could be a physical gift. It could be, you know, purely psychological or emotional. And sort of the antithesis of gratitude is when we take things for granted. And, you know, who is easier to take for granted than the person that you're living with and, you know, whose generosity and goodwill you benefit from every single day, almost every single moment of every single day. In you know, Jess Alberts and Angela Trethewey, in their essay, their contribution to the volume, they talk about ways, especially around household chores, almost more than anything else. It's so easy to take the other person for granted. And yet, very basic, simple, but heartfelt expressions of gratitude can really transform a relationship and transform the entire tone of one's home life. And it's a really powerful notion and one that they've actually backed up through their own research.
Keying off, if you will, some of what Robert Reich was suggesting, I'm really interested for all sorts of reasons, how in a society good people can be bystanders and how if we're really going to have a good society, those bystanders need to become actors. What's that transition? What will help that or what prevents it?
Well, it's a great question and one that is, I think, incredibly timely as well, because we're at a moment right now where there is tremendous risk and you know potential calamity that could come from being a bystander, not just to things in your own community, but even on a global scale. You know, talking about climate change and essentially not recognizing one's own stake or responsibility to take action for these problems that we maybe know are happening, but don't quite see exactly how we ourselves should be responsible for addressing them. I think, you know, what Robert Reich points out and what a lot of the research on bystanders has suggested is that, first and foremost, it's really essential to have people recognize their own personal stake and personal connection to problems at hand. There's some fascinating research conducted by Deborah Small and George Lowenstein on getting people to take action and contribute to charities for people who are starving in Africa. And they found that when they presented people with the story of a single girl, people were far more likely to take action than when those same people were presented with stories of
2 million starving Angolans.
Exactly. So really trying
somehow
to foster.
Now they're not getting out of their seat.
Exactly.
But one girl
was enough to significantly change people's reaction and motivation to take action. And in fact, when the story was combined with the statistics, people actually gave less than the story alone. So really fostering that personal connection and personal stake in some type of problem or bigger issue is essential and, you know, can't be overestimated. It's in some ways the first step. And in the same way, a lot of the bystander research has suggested that when people feel like someone else will take action, that this is maybe a problem that they recognize, maybe even see their own personal connection, but if there is a diffusion of that responsibility and others seem like they may be just as likely to come forward and help, people are less likely to come forward themselves. And, you know, there's a tip given out if you twist your ankle or, you know, suffering from a heart attack and you fall on the sidewalk, you should not just say, help me. You should say, hey, you there, you know, in the blue tennis shoes, I need your help. And single out that person as the person who can help you and not just lead that person or everyone else to think that someone probably will come to your
aid. Somebody's called the facilities, the authorities. Yeah.
So, you know, in the same way, I think that's true in interpersonal relationships, it's true on the street, and it's true on a global scale. It's really fostering a direct and personal connection to whatever the problem may be is truly essential.
Converting bystanders into actors is really part of our mission, which is we now know from a science of altruism that, for example, when you study the altruistic heroes and heroines of the world, the first thing they tell you, like Paul Rusesabagina, who saved the Tutsis during the massacres in Rwanda, is that altruism and compassion and kindness were part of his family conversation. It was on the dinner table. It was in the air. It was in the bedtime stories they read, and to be part of that. A second thing we've learned scientifically is that exposing people to cooperative words, if I just present on a screen the word kind or hug, so fast you don't even know what you've seen, that presentation of the word makes people more cooperative and altruistic. So part of our interest with the compassionate instinct is to get these concepts out there and to translate them to stories that parents can talk about or healthcare providers. So I think that's part of what we're up to.
So much for crush the competition, kill the other guy. Oh, all last millennium words.
Yeah,
exactly. Well put.
And you know, I would add to that also, I mean, what's really interesting about the bystander research is that no one wants to be a bystander, and yet we all fall prey to some of these same influences of situations that make us bystanders. And what's really interesting about some of the research on bystanders is that when you make people aware of the situations and the kinds of social cues that can make people become bystanders, they then take that knowledge and become less likely in the future to be bystanders. So it's like a very basic knowledge is power type of finding, but just making people aware of how they themselves, even the best, the most moral person in the world, can still fall prey to these influences. It makes people, just that knowledge of how they themselves can fall prey makes people less likely to fall prey to those same bystander effects in the future.
Now, it's easy when we talk about science, when we talk about the fMRI, all the new neuroscience and what we're looking at here, and that's kind of out there. Mm-hmm. It's easy when we talk about genetic biomarkers and we can trace that. That's kind of like, yeah, that's all the new talk about. One thing that we all have and we're all in touch with is our own body. And Dacher, you talk about some research that you did, a touch experiment, that finally, at the end of the day, when I read that, which was very early on, but I read it and I went, yep, our bodies are part of us. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone can relate to it. Would you tell us about
that?
Sure.
Well, thanks for asking. One more, you know, touch is is one of the oldest communicative systems that humans have. It predates language. It involves this amazing thing we have called the hand, and our skin is this biochemical factory that is processing information about touch and warmth and microbes and the like. And my former student, who's a professor now, Matt Hertenstein, and I were interested in a really simple question, which is, can I communicate these pro-social emotions we've been talking about today, like gratitude and love and compassion, by touching a stranger on the arm? There are mounting evolutionary arguments that suggest that for kindness to spread in groups and sort of reset our competitive tendencies toward more cooperative ones, you've got to be able to spread kindness or goodness to other people really quickly. And so touch is a good candidate. So what we did is we brought two strangers to the lab, and they sat on the opposite side of a barrier from one another. They couldn't see or hear, hopefully smell each other. And then one person stuck his or her arm through this barrier, this hole with a curtain, and the other participant was given a list of emotions and asked to try to communicate anger or disgust or compassion or gratitude or love to the stranger just by touching that person's arm for a second. Then the person guesses what just happened, what emotion. And we were shocked. The levels of accuracy are around 60% when chance guessing was 8% for compassion and gratitude and love. That is amazing. With a little fleeting touch to the arm, you can pick up these emotions. And then we've been extending this in different ways. People in high-touch cultures are better at it, like Spain. And we have this great gender difference that I think your listeners will appreciate and perhaps cry a little bit about, which is when the only gender differences we observe were when women try to communicate anger to the man. He had no idea what she was doing. And then
am I not surprised?
And then
did he say yes, dear? I just want to ask if that was never mind.
Right, yeah. That just spontaneously came out.
Yeah.
And then regrettably, when the man tried to communicate compassion to the woman, she had great difficulty in interpreting what he was doing. So there is some interesting variation, but our message is that, as you say, Maura, that our moral instincts are in our bodies, right? And they're in our how we touch each other and how we build up networks of cooperation.
I would add to that 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 doesn't mean that humans are just good and compassionate and the story ends there. I think really what the science is suggesting more broadly is that just as we've long believed that humans are wired to be aggressive and selfish, there is this other very important story about human nature, is that we're also wired to be compassionate and loving and altruistic. So really what's important then to understand is that there are outside situational and social factors that elicit either our more aggressive, competitive, selfish nature or that more compassionate, good nature. And so to come away from this isn't just to think everything we've been told about human nature is wrong, but that it's really only half the story. And understanding both halves is essential to then understanding how we can create a society that does more to elicit the more compassionate side of human nature rather than just stoking the negative and more selfish side.
Well, Dacher and Jason, you come back and see us anytime. We want to feel how much better we are at being good. We want to learn all we can.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you. Thanks, Margaret.
My guests today are Dacher Keltner and Jason Marsh. The book is The Compassionate Instinct, The Science of Human Goodness. It's published by W.W. Norton. More information about this interview is available at www.technation.com. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
You've been listening to the IT Conversations podcast edition of TechNation with Dr. Moira Gunn. Most editions of TechNation are recorded at the studios of KQED in San Francisco. TechNation is also available on over 200 public radio stations throughout the United States, as well as on Armed Forces Radio. Please check your local listings for time and availability.